Good evening. My name is Marissa Levine, and I am the director of Inforum here at the Commonwealth Club. And welcome to tonight's program, Breakthrough, Driving Public Value Through Private Innovation. Now, if you're new to Inforum or the club tonight, our video is the perfect window into the types of programming that we do here. We've hosted everyone from Chief Technology Officer Megan Smith to Dr. Cornell West to Dan Savage. We bring brilliant people and brilliant speakers together to share and learn and meet one another live, or else you'd be home just listening to a podcast. So please ask questions of our panelists and ask questions of each other. It's a great room of people. I see lots of familiar faces. Did you know that the club hosts more than 400 programs a year? We cannot do this, however, without the incredible foundation of members, volunteers, donors, and other supporters. So if you are interested in getting involved, please see any of us on the way out, and we would love to tell you how to do that. Now, there's a bunch of great programs coming up, so if you love tonight, come back again and again and again. On March 30th, here at noon, we will actually have the Deputy U.S. Trade Representative Robert Holleyman focused on the digital economy, which would be pertinent to many of you here today. On March 31st, Shannon Watts of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. On April 13th, we will switch venues and we will head to the Castro, where we will be hosting Shaka Sengor and Van Jones, who you just saw in the video, for a conversation around criminal justice reform that will be incredible. May 4th, we host the Chief Data Scientist of the United States, DJ Patil. May 26th, Jessica Herron, CEO of Stella and Dot, and I could go on, but I will stop there, so check out our tickets or see someone on the way out. Now, after tonight's program, we'd love to have you stick around, come grab a glass of wine, a little bit of cheese, chat with our incredible panelists and each other just down the hall in our fireside room. Now, we are not one of those venues that tells you to turn off your phones. In fact, take them out. Follow Inforum SF on Twitter, and please feel free to share photos, insights, anything like that. We'll be live tweeting the event and encourage you to do the same. And now, but please turn your ringers off. We don't like ringers, just Twitter. And now I'm going to introduce tonight's panel so that when they get up here, they can dive right into the good stuff. So our first panelist, Mike Olson, co-founder, chairman, and chief strategy officer for Cloudera, a platform for data analytics with multiple public sector clients and a focus on societal impact. Jay Nath, the first ever chief innovation officer for the city and county of San Francisco, where he partners with the mayor, city departments, and city residents. John Kabeka, the director of the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office down in Silicon Valley, who tailors the PTO's programs to our unique Silicon Valley stakeholders and industries. Plus, he's been there for 27 years. He knows everything. Seema Gandhi, who is the head of business development and strategy for Plaid, an API for banking data, whose background also includes time in the public sector in the Department of Treasury and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And then finally, tonight's moderator, Raj Sharma, is a social entrepreneur focused on helping the public sector really leverage the innovations of the private sector to solve big challenges. He is the founder of Sensio Consulting Group and most recently the founder of Public Spend Forum, which builds a global community of public-private partnerships like those we'll be discussing this evening. So I'm going to welcome them to the stage. Give us a second to clip them in so you can actually hear them, and we'll get this show on the road. Thank you for joining us.
Yes.
Got that, yeah.
Five panels, five clicks. It's the only way. Thank you.
All right, ready to go. Good evening. I'm really excited to moderate this panel tonight on a very important topic, private innovation for the social good. Can anyone guess how much U.S. governments, local, state, federal, spend on just purchasing? Any wild guess? Anyone guess how much U.S. governments spend on purchasing?
$500 billion.
Getting close. Okay, I'll just say $2 trillion. So that's federal, state, and local, $2 trillion to buy anything and everything. Globally, that number exceeds over $8 trillion. Regardless of the side of the aisle you're on, and I know nobody here picks sides, we all want that money to be spent efficiently. Even more important than the money, It's that we want to make sure that we're effectively solving some of our nation's most pressing challenges that governments are trying to address, whether it's education, poverty, cyber warfare, healthcare. And the fact is, there are a lot of innovators, entrepreneurs, and businesses of all sizes ready to work with government to solve these problems. But they're often stifled by the process, the rules, the speed, the culture, you name it. And we'll hear some of that today. I really think of these as barriers to entry and barriers to innovation. These barriers are so significant that sometimes some of the best and most innovative companies don't want to work with government. And that's a loss for all of us. And personally, I believe this is an important, important issue because we're missing out on solving some of our biggest challenges. So what can we do to change that? Where every critical technology or solution out there is available for the public good? Luckily, our panel has all the answers tonight. So I'm going to go ahead and get the dialogue started. Do something quick here. And to help us set the stage for tonight's discussion, I'm going to ask each of our panelists to, in 1 minute or less, give us three words that come to mind when you think of private sector and government collaboration and why. So we'll start there, Jay.
Slow, Byzantine, potential. Obviously, we know that government is hard to work with. There's a lot of barriers to entry, a lot of friction in that process, and it limits the pool of candidates. But as you mentioned, $2 trillion worth of spend, if we are smart about how we spend that, we can make huge impact in society. And so I think this conversation is really about that. How do we harness that investment, which is really our dollars, in a very thoughtful and impactful way?
Great. Seema?
So mine are going to sound very similar to Jay's, which probably tells you that we're might all be in agreement here, but the three that come to mind for me are very traditional. The partnership is very traditional. They're also quite opaque. I don't think there's much visibility into how government actually engages with the private sector. And the third is it's high potential. And that's a bit comforting that we both landed there because it suggests that there is potential for actually changing and really leveraging these relationships in a way that does good and makes sure that the $2 trillion that we're apparently spending are effectively and efficiently spent.
Great. John?
So I'm going to say essential, number one. We have to work together if we're going to enact change. So that's, I think, key and number one of my three. Second is it's evolving. I think we've come a long way in the President's Open Data Initiative as well as other mechanisms to make government as transparent as it can be. And that's directly tied to that is our engagement with the private sector. And then third, it's still slow, right? So even though we have made great headway, there's still some room to grow and room to expand and room to make it better and to increase our engagement with the private sector.
Great. Mike?
Good high-level summaries. I'm going to change the approach a little bit. My three words are healthcare.gov. In both the really disastrous way, the problems that that effort had in rolling out originally, and then in the miraculous recovery, right, bringing in a bunch of innovative technologists, I think shows both sides of what's wrong with and where the opportunity is in private-public collaboration.
Great. So I think there's some of the and the skepticism and the things that we see, and there's also hope. And I think we see that both in the government and kind of the private sector participants here. So there is hope. That's a good start. So, and by the way, does anybody in the audience have any other words to add?
Intelligence.
Sure.
High potential by precedent. Many examples already exist that aren't yet internet connected, that can be connected. And there is a complex wave of people who've done these partnerships already that you can build on.
Okay. Great. So there's a lot of lessons to learn from. I'm going to take one more just to make sure we get to our panelists.
I just have one word, digitization.
Great. And we'll definitely hear about that tonight. So, you know, with that, actually, we'll go to digitization and probably appropriate to go to Mike first. Mike, I had a chance to dig around on your website. And as I was saying to Mike earlier, I believe he knows everything that's on his website, on Cloudera's website. I found a couple of interesting stories. One was a story about Cloudera technology that's being used to predict and prevent veteran suicides, mm-hmm. a hugely important issue for those who have served and for the country as a whole. Another story remarked about this what the Singapore government is doing to create the world's first smart nation and provide more access to relevant data. So very different types of issues and goals. Whether it's the Singapore, whether it's Singapore or the remarkable work around preventing veteran suicides, what are the specific public policy initiatives that excite you about the potential working with government?
Can I give just a little bit of background on what
absolutely.
We do?
So
that seems like a huge range. How could a company possibly be doing that? We're a big data company. So we build software that can capture, store, analyze very diverse kinds of information, an enormous volume, builds on some of the early technology that Google invented back in the zeros. The two examples you cited are great examples of things we can do with data that we could never do before. The work we're doing with Patterns and Predictions, which is an organization aimed at veteran issues, veteran suicide in particular, is opt-in. Veterans who've returned from war have access to civilian and also military social media, email, other services where they can connect with people, share information, write about themselves. They're able to opt into this program, and when they do, their posts are now visible to Patterns and Predictions as well. Patterns and Predictions uses text analytics and machine learning over very large data volumes from that entire population to spot symptoms of depression or other issues early, right? In ways that maybe even the veteran himself or herself doesn't. And to help caregivers intervene to basically help those folks before they reach a crisis. And it's been very effective in the populations that are studied, a dramatic decrease in acute outbreaks of depression, including a reduction in suicide. So pretty meaningful stuff. Way on the other side of the spectrum, smart cities. So, you know, where's the traffic? When did the street lights go on? How did the stoplights behave? When are ships coming into and out of the harbor? Everything is sensorized these days, and it's possible to collect that data in ways we never could before. And analyzing it in volume, looking for patterns of traffic flow and problems in the city is possible because we can bring to bear analytics that weren't possible before. You asked about the specific policy initiatives mm-hmm. that we care about. Healthcare is huge, right? It's an area that we're very, very active in. Defense and military, frankly, big consumers of this technology for force protection and other stuff. And I think as well, surveilling and monitoring finance flows, watching the stock markets and economies for signs of bad behavior and of trouble. Also a big way in which we engage with government and with the private sector.
Great. I think what's interesting is, you know, there's so many different applications, and we're just talking about one company here. So it's very exciting to hear as a citizen. John, I'm going to go to you next. And so Silicon Valley, we all know, has long been the incubator for innovation. 1 in 8 registered patents come from this area. So congratulations to everyone here. PTO, the Patent and Trademark Office, opened an office in San Jose last year, and that highlights that fact further. As head of this office and someone who is at the front lines of interacting with innovators and entrepreneurs, can you give us your perspective on the potential of private sector companies to help help solve some of the significant social and public policy challenges?
So I think, the best piece of advice that I could offer to help that you know that the private sector can do to help deal with social and policy issues in the public sector is to engage with the public sector often and early and often. So you know we and as I mentioned earlier, you know, with the President's Open Data Initiative, you know, that has translated to many agencies making their data public for the first time, you know, in their history. At the USPTO, we've been making our data public for many years, and from that, you know, we've seen industries spawn off of that, the use of that data. And so we've actually realized that not only through the sharing and being transparent of the information that's taking place in the public sector, we're actually helping other industries thrive. In the Department of Commerce, for example, we hired our first ever chief data officer. Mm-hmm. And just a couple weeks ago, Secretary of Commerce Pritzker was out here in the Silicon Valley meeting with startups that, and five startups she met with, and each of them use commerce data in a certain way, whether it be patent data, census data, weather data, manufacturing data, across the different bureaus at the Department of Commerce. And so the data that's being used now, the government data that's being used in the private sector, is helping to further and advance those business models. So one thing about having a regional office here on the West Coast and specifically in San Jose, that gives stakeholders, specifically in the innovation industries, so that small businesses, entrepreneurs, big businesses, the opportunity to engage with the USPTO at even a deeper level. Mm-hmm. Not just flying to Washington, D.C. To raise a specific issue that may be of importance, but it actually gives us the ability now to host roundtable discussions here, get stakeholders at all levels to engage. You mentioned earlier about no one has a view on specific parties. Usually when it comes to intellectual property issues, it's usually not a partisan issue. The issues are between high tech and biotech, or between small companies and large companies. And so it's really important for us, which kind of goes towards my comment. My first comment is this, change can be slow when we're engaging in public-private partnerships. But a lot of that is because we try to strike the balance across our different stakeholder communities. And we can do that much more directly now that we have an office in the Silicon Valley at all levels, whether it be for small businesses and entrepreneurs or IP stakeholders or even at the international level.
I'm just curious, is there one issue that rises to the top in terms of what you've seen as companies and different stakeholders have come to you?
So, issues of late have dealt directly. It's kind of a weedy, part of intellectual property law, but specifically with Supreme Court decision in Alice and how that changed the way our examiners deal with subject matter eligibility. So it's a kind of a weedy issue, but that's one that has impacted all stakeholders, those that are trying to gain entry into the system, because the way we review the applications now has changed a little bit. And so if you already had an application pending at the USPTO prior to when the Supreme Court issued the decision, all of that is kind of applied retroactively. Mm-hmm. So companies have had to find creative ways to secure their patent protection or to, kind of look at all the different forms of intellectual property as a way to protect themselves.
Great. And maybe we'll come back to that. I have a couple of other thoughts. Seema, you've crossed both public and private sectors, as was mentioned in your intro. You and I had the opportunity to work together at the Center for American Progress on the economic policy team. Then you worked to help stand up the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. I mention all of that because you've got perspective from coming from both sides. So now you're at Plaid. I read the paper that you sent me, and I can't say I completely understood all of it, but maybe Seema can be kind enough to explain. But tell us how you think a company such as Plaid can make a difference in creating financial inclusion, and how does a partnership with government help you accomplish that goal?
Yeah. So Plaid, just for background, has built a financial platform that sits on top of old banking infrastructure. And essentially what we do is we take that infrastructure and make it more pliable so that it's easier for big companies to communicate with new companies and conversely for new companies to communicate with the old companies. So examples of our clients include Venmo, right, P2P. And when we first started working with them, they were tiny, and now they process 2 billion transactions a month or something. So really great growth story for us, but also a really great example of how things change over time. And the paper that Raj is referencing is actually about why consumer access to their own data is really important for preserving optionality in this ecosystem. And so when we talk about public and private partnerships and we talk about how companies interact with the government, I'd say we're right in the middle of some of those conversations right now. And I think it's rare for a fintech company or even for Silicon Valley to turn to DC and say, look, we need some help here. But I think this is a prime example of how, you know, in a very different way, private companies need public partnerships because at the end of the day, it's about consumer protection. It's about preventing big traditional players from necessarily shutting out innovation and for protecting product innovation and consumer choice. So some things, I think we were talking a little about financial inclusion. We have over 6,500 developers on our platform, and some of them are building really neat, innovative products like automatic savings matching. So if you save $500, they'll match you. And that's great for low-income families and encouraging positive behaviors. Others help people even out their cash flow so that they don't get into situations where they're looking for payday loans. And then, of course, there are others like the Venmos, which are fun P2P. But all of that is about creating the ecosystem, and government has a large role to play in protecting that.
Great. Great. Now, it was exciting to read that, and I definitely got a different perspective of how a technology like this can really enable financial inclusion. Jay, as the Chief Innovation Officer of San Francisco, your role is to create, and I'm quoting from the website, lean government and an environment that allows innovation to flourish.
You guys just stop. This is the most innovative person in San Francisco at the end of the hour. Respect.
I've got some people out back there.
No, so we're excited to hear. Tell us some of the specific initiatives that you're undertaking that make it easier for companies like Cloudera, like Plaid, and others to work with government.
Yeah, just to give a little background. So I was brought into this role, and the mayor created this role in January of 2012, and had some big supporters there from Code for America, Jen Palka and Tim O'Reilly, have been longtime partners of our city and across the country, driving innovation in government. And we see ourselves as a bridge with the broader community here in San Francisco and globally. How do we bring in new ideas, new approaches, talent? And we want a government that's more permeable, that's more collaborative. And so our focus has been really about those partnership models. What are those frameworks that we can establish to create value for everybody? And I'll share a few examples with you. One is around startups. There have been the engine of sort of change in so many other sectors, but the public sector. And if you look at Mary Meeker's latest presentation on the state of the internet, there's a slide that shows sort of the penetration of startups across different sectors. And the public sector is sort of the last frontier for startups. And yet, it's a huge commercial opportunity, right? Those numbers that you quoted. And we're often good customers, too. If you can actually sell to us, the retention rates are probably, you know, the highest across any other sector. But we know the barriers, right, the long sales cycles. So one program that we launched is called Startup in Residence, and it's a really interesting idea. Let's embed startups within government around specific issues that we've identified. And so traditionally, startups think of government as sort of a big do not enter sign, and we wanted to say, hey, actually we can be great collaborators with you. And so we had nearly 200 startups from 25 cities and countries apply to the program. It's a 16-week voluntary program. Six startups were selected, and many of them flew in from other parts of the world to be part of this program on a weekly basis. That demonstrates the value of being able to work with government and to create value. And just, I'll share one example. In SFO, if you actually fly to Terminal 2, you'll see these little iBeacons all throughout the terminal. And there's about 500 that were installed by union staff, procured in under 16 weeks. And they developed a system with a company called Indoors out of Vienna, Austria, to help visually impaired and blind travelers navigate through the airport. And so they created a whole new market for themselves, the airport, which is a multi-billion dollar market. And they are seeing a lot of interest across different cities. That being said, 2 years later, the RFP is still being baked. And so we are now tackling that problem. And so we got a grant from the federal government, from Department of Commerce. We learned from that experience, and we're now making some procurement changes. So one thing that we did is that now it takes 30 to 60 minutes for a startup to apply to be part of an RFP. And for government staff, it now takes hours instead of months to generate an RFP. And so what we did is we combined 17 RFPs into one RFP, and we brought everything digitized. Like, why are we dealing with paper still? So everything's online, everything's in a cohort, everything's moving. So 17 challenges across 9 agencies, and we're working with 3 other cities, San Leandro, West Sacramento and Oakland, sort of all as a cohort. And we're creating a brand and a global network. We've partnered with Amsterdam. They're just completing theirs. And so we have 12 other cities that we're starting conversations with. And it's really to send a signal to entrepreneurs that, hey, we're ready to work with you. Some cities, at least, are ready to work with you, and that we can be good partners. And part of that is training our staff. The vocabulary of startups, how do you work with startups? How do you de-risk that sort of engagement process? And also for startups, how do you work with government? Who's your economic buyer? What's an RFP? What is open data? All of those things. So we have a 16-week training curriculum as well. And we want that information for every entrepreneur, not just the entrepreneurs in our program. So we're digitizing that and putting that out there. So that's one of the programs that we are leading to try to drive public-private partnerships.
Great. I think we hear a lot of good examples here. I'm just going to probe a little bit deeper and ask you all to think about, you know, any other examples and something specific that, you know, that really enabled that collaboration between private sector and government. And if you could, anybody could start, but what was something specific that we can take away that actually made this happen? Because we hear different examples like the ones you just cited, but sometimes, you know, I facilitated a roundtable in Silicon Valley last year where some venture capital firms, they said, you know, we wouldn't touch government for anything, right? And our startups would bleed to death. So I'm just curious about specific things that you think enabled those partnerships.
So actually, I can take the other side of that story and talk about, from the fintech perspective, a company that tried to work with the government. And so we, having spent time in the federal government and having understood how government spends and opportunities for our technology to add value, I was really excited about the opportunity for us to help prevent fraud, to create more efficient spend. And I'll give you 2 tangible examples of what we could do. So a couple months ago, 60 Minutes ran this special, and they said, you know, there are these people that are taking and stealing identities and filing taxes for 10 people, and they're getting these tax refunds and running with the money. It's like, Plaid could totally solve this problem. We could actually analyze that this account has received 10 tax refunds. We could match the name on the account with the application, and problem solved. You're no longer sending the wrong tax refund to an account that already has 10 tax refunds. This is great. We'll save the government billions of dollars. And I'm a former tax lawyer and a former tax policy person, so I was super excited. I was like, great, I get engaged with the IRS. This is great. You know, having been there and knew people in 18F and DDS, which are these new departments that Obama has taken a real interest in, particularly, I think, to actualize some of the same sentiments that you were expressing, which is, how do we become more digital? How do we think about engaging with entrepreneurs? So ring up a couple of friends. Hey, guys, like, I think we could save the government billions of dollars. Like, what do we do? They're like, okay, well, you need to get on this thing called Schedule 70. And there's this procurement thing, but don't worry, we'll walk you through it. There's an incubator and a lot of the stuff that Jay was talking about. So we're like, okay, great. We'll get on the fast track. We're going to have our hands held. We're going to be innovative and work with the government. Fast forward 6 months, and we're like, this is unbelievable. Like, we can't do this. We're a small company, and they're talking about some other startups dedicating 5 people to going through this apparently more efficient process. We said, you know what? Hands tied. And actually talked to Raj a little bit, and this kind of comes back to what I started off with, saying that it's a really traditional industry. It's opaque. And at the end of the day, it does still feel very relationship-based. As transparent as you want to say in RFP processes or these incubators, it's about meeting people, having them understand what you can actually do and solving that way. So I think that it's great to hear these sentiments, because others, I don't even think we would have gone as far as we did and have the conversations that we're having now. But at the same time, I can say that from a startup perspective, trying to work with government or even federal government, maybe San Francisco's a little different.
I think we're a little different.
And you've got to start somewhere, so kudos to the people that are doing that. But at the same time, you know, as a taxpayer and as someone who does care about the public sector, it's a little frustrating to think of how much the government could actually be doing. And, you know, a good example is, what's the last time you engaged with a government app? Like, do you guys have a government app on your phone? No. Do you have an app by the federal government on your phone?
No, I have C-Click-Fix.
Yeah. Which one?
C-Click-Fix. It's a real-time reporting
that it's Oh, good. Okay, good. That's here in San Francisco? Or is that a federal?
It's everywhere.
Okay. C-Click-Fix. C-Click-Fix, right? I'm being told to repeat the name. Okay. Okay, good. So that's great. I'm glad. I did a poll of my friends who were in D.C., and they said, There is one federal government app, and it tells you if the government is open or not. And they pulled it, out and said, look, there's a snowstorm. It's closed. I was like, that's great. That's innovative.
Just,
so
I think the counterpoint to that is we recognize that we're not good at sort of customer experiences and digital experiences. And so I think that when you talk about C-Click-Fix and other applications, we see our value add is a sort of a data broker, right? Where we have all this data. If we can actually unleash it, people can create great products and services on top of that. And so something we did for San Francisco, and it's sort of in a number of cities, is we created a read-write API and said, we're not just going to share data, but we're going to let developers and others write data back into our systems for 3-in-1. So C-Click-Fix was a pioneering company working with us in a number of other cities. It's now in 50 cities. So I think there is partnership. So another great example is GTFS. It's what powers Google Maps when you take the public transit option. It's in several hundred cities across the globe. Those are partnerships with public agencies. And I don't think any other organization could do that at the scale and speed other than a Google. So I think there's the bureaucracy, and we're fighting that locally, and I think we can do that faster than the federal government. But there's some great examples where partnerships have paid off and have really impacted society in a very positive way.
So can I go back to your point on the government apps? Because we were actually looking into this a couple of years ago, and we realized that through the providing of data and through APIs and through other mechanisms, we didn't want to actually hinder the growth of another industry by creating our own products. And we might not do it in a robust or creative way as, say, a startup would. So we wanted to be able to make sure the data was available so that it could be used in these new ways and ways beyond our current thinking that are kind of pushing the envelope, which kind of goes to my other point on, with disruptive technologies. You know, we look at the whole autonomous vehicle industry, which are spending, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, if not more, in developing technologies that are illegal on today's roads because they believe in the system, right? They know that eventually government's going to catch up, right? It's, but at the same time, like, the government has to make sure that any regulations that are put in place, you know, ensure the safety of our citizens. And it goes back to that balanced approach, you know, across the entire stakeholder community, not just the one that wants to get their product, you know, in the marketplace that's currently, you know, against whatever regulation it is. And so we are very much willing and want to work with the stakeholder community, which is why I said earlier is, you know, engage early, engage often, you know, and also I think something that goes a long way is to work together, right? Not just between private-public partnerships, but look at other organizations that are out there that are trying to seek that same goal. For example, reform with autonomous vehicles, and do you really need a steering wheel if the car doesn't have a driver, right? So, but right now you have to have one, right? Because that's what the regulation says. So as you're trying to advance technology, you know, bring the government with you.
Can I pile on? I want to give another example that is not just government to a single company, but a community. We participated in something called the Precision Medicine Initiative. It's an initiative that President Obama kicked off about a year ago. Backstory is, ever since in the 1800s, we figured out that germs were not bad and caused a lot of disease. We've done research and we've created studies and we've looked at populations and we've tried to design treatments that make most people better, right? So for about 150 years, we've been doing medicine aimed at the average patient. But there aren't that many average patients. It turns out that there are a lot of diseases you can have that are unique to you, your specific genome or microbiome, where you are in life, and so on. If you can sequence the genome of cancer, if you can understand the specifics of the health of an individual, you may be able to deliver a very targeted therapy that wouldn't be broadly effective, but that's unbelievably effective in that one place. And that's precision medicine, right? So use data, use technology, use a whole bunch of science to attack disease. If you're going to do that, you want to bring together a whole bunch of stakeholders, right? There's people that have a whole bunch of data about old disease treatments and how that worked. You've got genetic sequencing that we can do now. We can get genome sequences at reasonable cost. You'd like the pharmaceutical companies to get that data and also share what they know about molecular structure in order to target treatments better. When the president kicked this initiative off, really the goal was to bring together a great big group of collaborators. It's working well because, first of all, there's a very hard focus on science in this administration. You know, it's great to see the National Institutes of Health and Centers for Disease Control, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid collaborating, sharing data. Obama's hired a bunch of Silicon Valley people out of Google, out of Facebook, elsewhere to join him. And I guess in a couple of weeks, DJ Patil, the U.S. CDO, is going to be here speaking. That's actually going to be an awesome event. He's really good. You should come. that bully pulpit has encouraged companies like ours to get involved. And then it's not just us, right? We're a technology provider, but the data brokers, Cerner and other companies that have the electronic medical records, have been enticed to participate as well. I think the administration has done a good job of focusing attention, providing some funding to NIH and others, but getting a bunch of companies excited and working together, not just through government, but with one another to attack these problems. It's pretty exciting.
Yeah, you know, so some of the things that I'm taking away here, you know, you talk about early engagement, and that's not that different at the end of the day than what we do when we're working with any clients in the private sector, right? Collaboration and partnerships, definitely, when you're taking on complex problems, and which seem to be some of the more complex ones on that government takes on, it does require a lot of community engagement and participation or just stakeholder engagement. So, you know, having said that, I'm just curious if you have any practical advice, other practical advice. First, Mike and Seema, from a private sector perspective, what are specific steps government needs to take to make it easier for companies like yours, and what advice would you be giving to Jay and John here? What do you want them to go back and do?
I've already heard from these two about my bugbear. Procurement reform is the single most important thing that we can do. Make it much easier for small companies to engage with government. And I'm glad to hear that some of that's ongoing. I think single-handedly that would fix a ton of problems. By the way, I think that the original healthcare.gov train wreck never would have happened if competent companies had been able to bid for that business, and they simply weren't able to get in the mix.
Yeah, I mean, I would echo that. And I think that some of that change is already starting to happen. I think AT&F and DDS are really big symbols of that change. And as we've been going through the process, they've actually been coming to us and saying, look, we understand this is really painful. Can we show you some of the stuff we're doing? Do you understand this? This is simple language. We're trying to tweak the website and asking for real-time feedback in a way that most startups would probably ask their focus groups for feedback around, and that's really heartening. And I think that another really important dimension of this partnership or this duality is that you get really talented people to go into the government. You have, you know, you saw this example with healthcare.gov. You had great technologists coming in, and you see this with AT&F and DDS. The government is now attracting really smart, great technology folks, and I think that you start seeing that change happen not only through the procurement process, but also in how they can engage with us and understand the technologies that can benefit the government.
Yeah, I think the ending here was happy, and it's great that we managed to get that problem fixed. But if you have to call in Superman, right, you screwed up, right? I mean, it just shouldn't be that hard to start with.
I think, you know, there's a couple of things that are really simple changes on the procurement side that doesn't require regulatory changes or anything. If you think about how we issue RFPs, they're really prescriptive, you know, huge documents. why not issue simple challenge statements? And the Obama administration has really led on that approach of saying, hey, this is the outcome that we want. We are not going to prescribe the path to get there. That's you, innovators, and our community and entrepreneurs to figure that out. And that's what we did with our startup program. We had 17 challenges, really short. They were two paragraphs long. That took departments literally hours to produce rather than weeks and months to produce those highly prescriptive requirements. And that can change things. For a startup, you can now really understand, okay, this is how I can add value really quickly instead of parsing through a really long document. The other thing you can do is the contracts that we have are really, they're difficult for a startup to parse, right? So why not make plain language and balanced risk? Right now, we push all the risk and liabilities to external vendors. And if you're a big company, you can assume those risks. But if you're a startup, you can go under. So I think starting from a place that's a little bit more balanced and plain language, I think would go a long way. The other thing is, you know, the process is broken, but can we at least give you a roadmap? I mean, let's do something simple like here's step one, here's step two, step three. Right now you have to go through a number of government websites to figure out what's happening or work with brokers or people who know how to navigate the system. And that's fundamentally not fair. It limits the pool of participants. And that's something that we as Americans should care about. We really want innovators to participate in this program. We need to reform procurement. It's a really key area.
And the term procurement reform doesn't sound like the most exciting initiative, right? To anyone?
I'm pretty fired up.
But you are. That's exciting to see. I thought I was the only one who gets fired up about that. By the way, what's interesting here is though we're hearing, you know, lots of really exciting examples, and I definitely have one having worked with government in terms of the kind of challenges that are really interesting, right, that we have to solve. And it really tests really our ability to innovate, our ability to think creatively, our ability to bring people together. So my last question.
Can I just chime in real quickly with a question? Because, when it comes to procurement, and I'm sure many of you have engaged with the federal government on procurement issues as well, did the federal government like the procurement process that they were imposing on you? I mean, everyone I talk to on the procurement side, you know, is equally frustrated within the federal government as you know, I hear from stakeholders outside the federal government. So it's complex, it's time consuming. You know, I do see the impact that a procurement process has on the end product, and I think that, you know, that is something that probably could use some additional attention.
Yeah, no, definitely. We see that people on either side, they're not happy with it, but there's also not a real solution because of the politics involved. And just any words of encouragement. I'd we're going to start taking questions soon, so there's a mic up here. If anybody wants to if we can line up there and we'll start taking audience questions. But what are words of encouragement based on you've cited some great examples, right? Yes, there are challenges, there are issues, complexity, but what are your words of encouragement on why more companies, others should really be at least looking into government and collaborating with government?
So I really liked Seema's comment, and it was something very much on the forefront of my mind as well, to help change the system and to help broaden perspectives within the federal government, become a part of it. And we've just been just very impressed with the caliber of people in the recent years that have come to the agency, not just my agency, but I've seen across the federal government, true experts, leaders in their field. I mean, here we have, you know, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, America's Innovation Agency, whose, undersecretaries worked in, the nation's largest high-tech industry. So they have the experience. They understand the perspective. They know what needs to happen to the system because they ask themselves, if I was head of the PTO, what would I do? And based on their private sector experience, and bringing that into the public sector is key. It's the way to help transform.
Great.
Yeah. Yep.
Anyone else? Any?
I would echo what John said, and a little bit glib. Oh, that damn government! It's just such a problem to do business with. Look,
spoken by the 27-year-old federal employee.
The buyers, the buyers in the federal government are exactly as frustrated. They'd love to be able to go and engage with more folks. What's been encouraging to me is to watch to watch agencies and the government generally create workarounds, right? Procurement reform is like reforming the tax code, right? I mean, it's complicated, and there's a bunch of people with a real stake in the way it works right now, and by God, they're going to defend it. And yet, a bunch of the agencies we work with have found ways to engage high-tech Silicon Valley companies that simply couldn't have figured out how to navigate traditional procurement. So I think that's super encouraging. And if we can use those lessons to create workarounds or shorter paths more broadly, we can swipe ideas from one another. I think that'd be great. And it is starting to happen.
Right. I'll just add, you know, it doesn't always have to be around this sort of commercial arrangement structure around partnerships. So we are asking, you know, people in San Francisco to help us with challenges that we have. So, for example, we shared the need for analysis on our 911 calls, and we didn't know why it was skyrocketing. And so we asked Google to help us, and they sent 4 data scientists in for 16 weeks to analyze. And the upshot was butt dials. That was the cause of all of this. And so, you know, that insight and the data analysis skill sets that they had, we didn't have those capabilities. Yep. So I think there's a broader calling here for people who live in San Francisco who care about their city. How do we work together on these societal issues? It's not government's job necessarily. It's too big often for any one organization or sector to tackle.
Great. Well, thank you. We'll go ahead and start with the questions.
One of the things in California that we're dealing with is what happened in Yosemite with the trademarking of Awani and Curry and Yosemite National Park. And I was wondering if in the Patent and Trademark Office, if there is a notion of public trust, that there's some places where things are not for sale and you can't go around and patent them, sort of like a laugh test. You know, because essentially what is happening is that we're reading, no matter what media, whether it's electronic or newspapers, old newspapers, that this is going to be a long legal battle, this thing. And the thing is, you have a public asset and you've got a private business that wants to privatize the worth and take it out of the public sector. And what do you think about that problem of, you know, here we are leveraging public value?
Sure.
John.
Not to conflate patents and trademarks, but, you know, the trademark issue with Yosemite right now, it's pending legislation, so I can't really comment on it. But at the same time, you know, I hope it's not a long battle. So I'm optimistic that it's not going to be a long, drawn-out battle. But it is, there's unfortunately not much I can say about it, except that it's, I understand your concern. I share it personally. When it comes to the patent system, though, once it's in the public domain, you know, you can't get a patent on it. The trademark issue is separate from that.
Can I just pile on very briefly? And I want to be,
sure.
I won't be the first guy John has heard say this. Yeah. I'm a software engineer, and like a lot of software engineers, I think software patents are an absolute disaster. Never should have been permitted in the first place. And I wish that we would stop issuing them. Given the IP legal regime we've got, I'm really pleased that the USPTO is adequately staffed to review these things and so on. So I think, you know, good for you, do that job. But I do think I make a living because of intellectual property law. I think it's incumbent on all of us to deliberate all the time about what IP really is and what sorts of IP we should permit, and from time to time to amend the law to recognize new truths. And so I sympathize with your point on Yosemite. I feel it pretty strongly in another domain. In the meantime, though, I think the USPTO has to do the job that it's been chartered to do.
So, and I'm just going to add 2 cents to that because we could probably spend a whole panel talking about this.
It sounds like a conversation over a beer.
The only thing
they
I
set
just
us right next to each other.
Right. I know that. I mean, when you think about what your product is or service that you're bringing to the marketplace, you have to think about what form of intellectual property or what forms of intellectual property are best going to protect that service or product that you're bringing to the marketplace. So, you know, it might be a patent, it might be open source, it might be a trademark, it might be a combination of the three with trade secrets or copyright protection. And so you have to think of the system as a holistic system. But, you know, I do like to think of our patent system of kind of its own sort of open source. I mean, it's based on full disclosure, right? That the patent system succeeds because you get a patent, it's a quid pro quo. You get a patent once you tell the world how to make and use your invention, which is very similar, you know, in concept with open source, you know, where you're like, here's the thing that you can use and here's how you can use it. And so I think there's a lot of parallels there. And when it comes to software, you know, the verdict's still out. I think it's very difficult to dissect software from the actual hardware that's running the software and how that's actually transforming, how software can transform a device to behave in a completely different way.
Longer conversation. Yeah. My concern is whether or not the patent is used as a cudgel to prohibit competition. But again, we should take this discussion.
Sounds like another panel, Marissa, that you need to organize. If we can keep the questions just brief and direct.
And actual questions.
yes.
So, I'm sorry. Thank you all for being on the panel tonight. My name is Carlo, board president for Inforum, on the board of the Commonwealth Club as well, in technology, trying to do social good and make it profitable. But question, how can we get more tech entrepreneurs to lack of better word or vocabulary here, to care about changing government?
I think we've demonstrated they want to. We had a voluntary program, 200 startups applied, and they were just amazing talent. So they want to work. They just don't know how to work with government. So we've made it really difficult, Schedule 70 and these just Byzantine processes. So I think the onus is on government to really think about how do we become better stewards of public dollars. And it's not just about, you know, ethics and, you know, waste. It's about innovation and about how do we use these dollars in the right way. And I think it's about making it easier to broaden that pool of people who can participate. The next best idea could be somewhere in your community. It doesn't have to be coming from a Fortune 500 company. So the work is on us in government. And I think we need to hear from entrepreneurs, hey, we want to work with you, but you guys are really hard to work with. Please, please, you know, change.
We want to work with you, but you're really hard to work with.
So I think it's not entirely on government. I think I think there ought to be an ethic of service in society generally and among technologists. You know, we called out Jen Palka a little while ago. It's great to see someone take a few years and not make a lot of money doing some really important work just because it's really important work.
I'd echo that sentiment. And I think one of the reasons that Plaid has involved in trying to work with the government, figure out a way to add value here, is because I've been there and I fundamentally do believe that people can do good for government. So I 100%. I'd also say it's probably incumbent on entrepreneurs who have cracked the code to help other entrepreneurs. So we'll chat later, right?
Yeah. So having said that, I've never done any public service work in my life. So.
Go ahead.
I was just going to just use the USPTO as an example. We created, I mentioned the Big Data Initiative and Open Data, Open Government, but we actually created an innovation lab within the USPTO, and we issue tech challenges, and we've been very excited with the response that we've got from the startup community. We like to call this innovation lab a startup within the USPTO that focuses on technical problems that we have at the agency and are issuing these challenges to help us solve them. And other departments are doing the same thing.
Great. I was just going to also add, what I've seen is we need to also communicate some of the interesting work and the challenges that others take on and do a better job communicating, because there's a lot of good, exciting work out there and it's not being communicated with a positive story. And usually what you hear is all the things that go wrong, like healthcare.gov, but not all the great stories that are actually do go right. And so we need to create more of a really communication around that.
Kind of building off that theme of communication and ease of working together, you know, many senior civil servants are baby boomers. They're approaching retirement age. And so my question is, with the ease of working together, the ease of explaining new technology, how much of it do you see as a generational issue that as baby boomers leave the civil service and leave the government and younger generations that are more aware of technology, more aware of the powers of technology, come into more senior roles, do you think it's going to be easier to kind of convince them of the merits of working or at least kind of using technology more effectively?
I think so. I mean, when I think about some of our senior leadership, when they don't use email, and some of it's, you know, for different reasons, but, you know, how do we change that? And it's generational. And so when people naturally are collaborative and are using Slack and different technologies, they bring that into the culture and it permeates. And so I that is one way of change. It's a slow way of change, but yes.
But I also think it's incumbent on the younger generation to bridge that gap, because if it's a product that does add value, then it's on us to make sure that that's communicated. So it goes back to communication as well. And if there's receptivity from the older generation, right, then I think that it can work. And I don't think it's an excuse to say we've got to wait for them to move on.
We need
on.
To build bridges too. So yeah. I think, you know, we were really inspired by Jen's work in the fellowship program. I mean, bringing young talent into government. And so we replicated that program. The White House has done that with the Presidential Innovation Fellowship Program. But how do you actually create those bridges to let people from other sectors, from the startup community, actually work in government? And, you know, I think that's a really important part, that human scale, like you need talent to come in and sort of change how things are done.
I agree completely. And I actually just dawned on me over the weekend that when I started working at the USPTO, I was the whippersnapper, right? So I was the 22-year-old, you know, coming into the federal service. And you know, I had just graduated college. You know, I'm used to working on a computer, and I started working at the USPTO, where we searched in paper, we hand wrote our office actions, we turned them into a typist, and there was two terminals where we could do some online searching, and we could use that terminal to also type up an action. And literally, we stood in line. All the new examiners would stand in line so we could use the computer. Now that we look at, you know, we have one of the biggest data warehouses in the federal government of our patent portfolios, and, you know, how we've transformed was also because the workforce helped that transformation take place. So I think we just need to recognize that it's not just the current new generation, it's every new generation that's hired into the workforce and to being receptive to fresh ideas.
Great.
Hi. So my name is Sarah, and I'd like to ask a question about the another side of the procurement process. So I'm a design strategist for a government vendor, and one of the things that I've seen is that a lot of state and local governments, their pain point is not necessarily just getting tech in the door, but it's also maintaining it, configuring it, keeping it updated for 6 months, 12 months, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years. I was wondering basically what you guys' experiences has been with startups and new technology kind of not just coming into the door, but then also working on contracts that may be like 3 to 5 years out or may need maintenance over the course of that whole time. What's been your experience around that?
I mean, I think cloud computing has changed the game, and we don't have to worry about maintenance, right? So a startup that is a two-person shop can provide services to a big agency or a big government. And for us, it's a huge shift, right? We don't have to have the resources to manage servers, to manage updates, et cetera, that sort of legacy model. And, you know, it's obviously transformed. The private sector is definitely driving change in the public sector as well.
From birth, we were doing business with insurers and big banks, and they had the identical concern, right? You're going to bring on a software solution. You're really making a bet on 8 people in San Mateo, California. And the answer is you pick the right problem, and if that solution is a good one and you're willing to run some risk, then it makes sense to do that. And hey, by the way, as that dinky little vendor, I want a customer, right? So I'm desperately going to service those guys. I don't think that concern is unique to government, but it's a legitimate concern, right? And it's on the buyer to weigh the value of the innovation versus the downside risk of, you know, a company that's not going to grow up. But a bunch of those little companies are going to turn into long-lived organizations able to deliver different kinds of products better.
Really cool discussion. Thanks so much. So a lot of what you were talking about had kind of an infrastructure-y feel to it, to the extent that, you know, kind of having the right rules and regulations and procedures and stuff in place so that the right people come to the table seems pretty vital. But the question is, from a government perspective, if you get the right people to the table, to what extent is it right, or are there opportunities for the government to kind of play a little bit of favoritism with the incumbents? Because there's got to be situations where you bring people in, especially if you're bringing in a lot of people doing different things, and there are certain people, companies, whatever, that where it really is much better for those people to thrive than not, and maybe some others. So that's the question, really, favoritism or kind of helping to kind of individual players along.
So I was at the Treasury Department when we were implementing a lot of Dodd-Frank, so financial reform. So this is around more or less the angle of procurement in particular, but just in terms of how government works. And I'd say that the government is probably starved for content experts. So when it comes to financial regulation and how traders work and markets operate, the government relied heavily on folks in the private sector to inform them. And that's actually a good thing, because it means that they're better understanding the day-to-day and how things operate. And I expect that you probably see this across agencies at energy, transportation, but it does create opportunity to influence. And so I'd say, you know, there are two things there. One, if you know things, go to the government, create a voice, create that relationship, because they want you there. They need you there. And I think the second side of it is, you know, there is a lot of talent in the government. And I always use this just joke with my friends, you should feel good that there are folks like us in the government, and it's your taxpayer dollars at work, and people genuinely do care, and there's a reason they're there, and it's you know, often very clear when someone is there to advocate for their position versus inform. So yes, there's room for favoritism, but you know, hopefully things like kind of public spend forum and other, you know, openness around procurement and different rulemakings make that more transparent and less an opportunity for undue influence.
Hi. So crudely, you can like define the political left and right by which of the public versus private part you mistrust more. And I think a lot of what's been talked about is how to alleviate a lot of the mistrust in from a conservative's point of view, like, you know, government is slow and whatnot. But what about the concern from somebody who's like leftist, like that corporations are fundamentally bad entities, and the idea of a good corporate citizen in the way that like we're talking about now to create social good doesn't exist, like. Isn't the point of rules and regulations in the first place to make sure that corporate citizens stay in line, right? So how do you like deregulate and still maintain, you know, good mechanisms to make sure people don't hurt other people?
I mean, one of the things that we've done is sort of collaborate pre-RFP, right? There's not a lot of regulations there, and you can do a lot of innovation. You can experiment, collaborate, and learn from those that period of sort of trying out new technologies, new approaches. And when you think about the societal changes that are happening both in healthcare, in transportation, around autonomous vehicles, sharing economy, these are sort of experiments that are happening at scale across our country and across cities. And if we're using procurement as sort of our vehicle to try to innovate, that's just a blunt instrument. And so you need a lot more flexibility than what procurement allows for and regulatory environment allows for. And it's there for a good reason, right? We don't want sort of undue bias. We don't want, you know, corruption, et cetera, a whole bunch of things. But I think we've gone too far in many ways, right? We need a little bit more of a balanced approach. And we need to be able to work together to solve these challenges that we're facing in cities and across the country.
Great. Okay, two final questions.
So we've talked a lot about specific government initiatives that have been sort of bootstrapping involvement, and we've talked about interfacing with government, but I think if we want a lot of this involvement in the public sector to scale, we probably want to create general patterns where private companies can make money without even interacting with the government involved in the public sector. And a lot of the distribution methods that have been evolving, where most startups are finding success now, have become walled gardens, like app stores or Facebook instant articles, things like that. And these companies have a real incentive to favor things that have high conversion rates or good click-throughs, and so they kind of become these very consumery sort of, some people have said, like trivial problems, you know, aimed at people who make money already and have money to pay. And so I was wondering if you see that as a problem and maybe something that we should be worried about in terms of these distribution channels being owned by companies themselves.
I'm going to cite a counterexample. I understand the concern you're raising. One of the one of the initiatives that most excites me at a federal, but even more state and local level right now, and you guys in San Francisco, we in San Francisco are doing this a lot, is the open data movement. I think that the government, I think that the data that is produced by taxpayers of its nature ought to be owned by the taxpayer. Now, there's some private stuff, like when you go to the VA or some census data that needs to be anonymized. But if the government publishes that data freely, they create a good that lots of different people, citizens and companies, can then exploit to try to create new value. And that's kind of the opposite of the App Store. Anybody can get that data, and anybody can do whatever combination of innovation they want to do. I think that's actually pretty exciting. The risk that you'll get stuck in, say, the Apple or Android App Store is real. But I don't think it's a unique challenge in government, right? It's anybody who wants to distribute content or software goods needs to navigate that thicket, right? So I don't think that's particularly unique to government. But I think government does have a very powerful tool in the data publishing that it's doing. And it ought to create a lot of economic value.
Can I ask one clarifying? I guess my question was more, should the government doing things to make it easier to navigate places like the App Store so that public sector involvement can be profitable?
I vote no. I just worry that the government regulation is a very, very blunt instrument for that sort of...
Tim O'Reilly, O'Reilly Media. I had a question on the patent issue. You mentioned that patents are intended to teach. And in the early days of the patent system, you were required to deliver a working model of your invention. Seems to me that many patents today are written by lawyers in language so broad that it's intended to cover a lot of possible future inventions, and they actually don't teach anything. There are many, many patents for which it is virtually impossible to build anything that works. Have you guys thought about, particularly in the area of business model and software patents, actually requiring a working model again? Because in the case of a software patent, you know, if you actually had to deliver, you know, a working program, I think it would utterly transform software patents.
Sure. So for the group, the standard that the examiner uses to determine whether or not the description is sufficient, right? So these examiners specialize in the technology that the applicant's seeking their patent protection in. And so they're considered kind of the ordinary artisan, someone of ordinary skill in that technology. So it's not... The abstract is written so that anyone of any skill in technology can understand what the invention is, but to make and use the invention requires a higher level of skill. So that's the standard the examiners use when they read through the specification. If they, believe that it's possible to make use the invention, they won't question it. If they don't, they will question it in the prosecution record. So it does get to kind of another weedy part of patent law, so I don't want to spend too much time on it here, but perhaps I can talk to you more about it afterwards. All right. Thanks.
So in the interest of time, and thank you for all the questions. This is a great dialogue. So I'm going to ask, end by asking each of you your 60-second idea to change the world. Jay, why don't we start from that side and come this way?
All right. Something that's sort of top of mind for me, universal internet. We have over 100,000 people here in San Francisco. 1 in 8 San Franciscans that have no internet access. 15% of our youth have no internet access. And so if we're going to create an equitable future for these, for our youth, and to be able to create a level playing field, we need to ensure that they have access to the most essential infrastructure for the 21st century.
To me, it comes back to the youth as well and giving each of them role models that they can relate to. I think it's huge for the country that we have, our first Black president here, and the role models and the hope that it creates and the vision for what these young folks can be is critical.
Both very good points. So my kind of vision for the world, though, is a patent system that works for the world. And right now, every country has its own patent laws. We work very closely with the industrialized nations as well as the developing nations to help them strengthen their IP protection. But getting harmonization is you talk about slow, right? So so having a global patent, I think, is our wish list. We've harmonized a lot in some processes, but actually harmonizing laws is going to be a heavy lift. So that's my ideal vision.
It's a big, big goal. Yeah.
And it will bring a lot more certainty to the IP system as well for the world.
Great. Thanks.
Come back to an idea that I spoke about just a little bit ago. I think it would be great if there were a requirement or expectation that everybody did 2 years of service. And especially folks like us in the tech sector, we think of government and the people, right? But if the people actually show up and be the government for a little while, first of all, I think it eliminates a dichotomy that is only in our heads for real, right? I mean, we're the ones who make society work. And a couple years of clever people working in government and seeing what the barriers and impediments really are has got to make society a better place. We got to be able to knock down a bunch of these problems and recognize those barriers better. So I know people who have done this. I respect them enormously, and I hope one day that I can join the club.
Great. Well, I think what we've heard today, there's challenges, but we also see a lot of really good examples of what's possible and a lot of different kinds of experiments going on. And that's what we've seen across the board. So I want to thank everybody for sharing their thoughts and ideas and to everyone for joining in. Thank you.